Hi, everybody. Liam here. Before we start today's episode, a few short messages from my sponsors. First, I want to tell you about a new exhibition opening at the Berkeley Art Museum and Pacific Film Archive on April 13th. It's called A Movement in Every Direction, Legacies of the Great Migration. 12 contemporary artists were commissioned to make works reflecting on the impacts of the Great Migration, a period when millions of Black Americans moved from the South throughout the United States, radically altering the economic, cultural, and political makeup of this country. Many artists drew from their own personal and familial histories, creating works that span generations and mediums, including painting, sculpture, photography, video, and textile. A Movement in Every Direction prompts us to consider how the Great Migration, and migration in general, have been a part of our own stories and our shared history, here in the East Bay and beyond. This exhibition is on view starting on Saturday, April 13th through September 22nd at BAM PFA in downtown Berkeley. Gallery admission is free on opening day and on the first Thursday of every month. Find out more at bampfa.org. Next, a message from UCSF Benioff Children's Hospitals. According to the California Department of Public Health, Black babies in the Bay Area are 2 to 3 times more likely to be born too soon or too small or even to die before their first birthday compared to white babies. Scientific evidence points to structural racism and a systemic lack of cultural awareness by providers among the causes of these disparities. To address this inequality in health outcomes, doctors and nurses at UCSF Benioff Children's Hospital Oakland created Bloom, the Black Baby Equity Clinic. This new clinic at UCSF Children's matches mothers and families with culturally responsive pediatric care and provides help like lactation counseling, checkups, and critical support. UCSF Benioff Children's Hospitals are committed to providing equitable care that makes a difference. To learn more about the Bloom Clinic, check out the link in the show notes or follow East Bay Yesterday's social channels. You're listening to East Bay Yesterday. This show is about history, but it's not stuck in the past.
Let's begin.
There's one little sliver of Oakland's waterfront that's always been a bit of a mystery to me. It's called Fifth Avenue Marina, and there's no other place like it. The vast majority of our shoreline is owned by the Port of Oakland, so it's super industrial. Giant cranes, loading docks, stacks of shipping containers as far as the eye can see. Then there's Jack London Square, with its little shops and restaurants. And a bit further south, there's Brooklyn Basin, which is one of Oakland's biggest new residential developments. Right now, there are thousands of modern apartments and an impressive park where a decrepit cargo terminal stood just a few years ago. But tucked in between Jack London Square and the new Brooklyn Basin development is the Fifth Avenue Marina, a place that I've heard jokingly referred to as Oakland's Riviera. It does not look like the luxurious Mediterranean coastline, quite the opposite, in fact. Compared to all the fancy developments going up around it, Fifth Ave looks like a relic from Oakland's rough and tumble days as a working waterfront, but with a healthy dose of surrealism. Picture a 10-foot tall Tyrannosaurus Rex made out of scrap metal, or a flying saucer, or a hippopotamus sculpture that appears to be pooping out a jade tree. You know, art. But it's not just the rusty warehouses and eclectic buildings and strange sculptures that make this place different. It's what goes on inside. The place is filled with artists, craftspeople, musicians, tinkerers, and blue-collar boaters. Years ago, I'd go down to Fifth Ave for breakfast. There wasn't a real restaurant, but there was a dude named Vinny who set up a little kitchen outside and he'd make you a plate of pancakes and eggs and all that good stuff for like $5. It was extremely informal, and eventually I heard that Vinny got shut down, so I hadn't been down to Fifth Ave for a few years. But when I decided I wanted to know more about Fifth Avenue Marina, like, how does it still exist? How did it come to exist in the first place? I reached out to Vinny. He promptly replied, "Talk to Schultz. Schultz has all the stories." Vinny was right. Schultz does indeed have all the stories. Oh, and like Beyonce or Cher, Schultz only goes by one name. And also like Beyonce or Cher, Schultz is a mesmerizing performer. Here's his impression of a friend of his who worked for the port, who happened to be from Montana.
"Oh, yeah, I'm from Montana. I'm up there in Montana. Up in Montana, we would have done it this way. We didn't stand for nothing, none of these hippies around here."
Sometimes when I'm doing an interview, I'll spend weeks doing research, preparing questions, carefully plotting out the conversation I'm hoping will unfold. Not with Schultz. I pretty much just showed up to his house with a microphone, hit record on my little device, and that was it. For about the next 5 hours straight, this 88-year-old man proceeded to tell me some of the craziest stories I've ever heard. One would flow right into the next. And the way he told these stories so vividly, it was like he was bringing some of these salty old roughnecks and the world they inhabited right back to life.
"There was all kinds of wood. As piers fell into decay, they'd tumble into the waterfront and boats would sink and they'd break up and drift around," which brings to mind down at, you fish stuff out of the water. I remember Jack Dickerhoff found a body floating one day in the estuary, and Jack was a tough old sailor, and he said, "I know that in Alameda County," he said, "they give you $5 for finding a floater." And he said, "So I put a line on that guy's foot and I rode him to San Francisco. They paid $10 over there." And then he rode back and with his $10 in his pocket and went to Dalkey's and had roast beef sandwiches. Yeah. Old Mr. Dalkey would set up there and he had a loft and a big, huge roll-top desk above the bar and a mezzanine up there. And Dalkey would watch down across the bar so those bartenders didn't pour the shots too long. And the Chinese cook, I remember Dickerhoff, he was a tough old guy. And he says, if that guy, he's cutting that roast beef so thin I could read the Chronicle through it. Yeah. But old man Dalkey would be up there looking down on the, he was a white-haired old gentleman too. A lot of beautiful, beautiful guys, old-timers around. I don't know, one by one, they all slipped away, but Oakland had such great, great care. Everybody knew everybody.
I love that line about how the roast beef was so thin, you could read the Chronicle through it. That's the kind of detail that Schultz peppers throughout all his stories. Something specific, visceral, and just a tiny bit exaggerated for comedic effect. Schultz's style is a perfect fit for the wild world of Oakland's post-war waterfront. This is a world he knew intimately, not only because he spent about half a century hanging out there, he also used to own a small chunk of it, about half an acre, right in the heart of the Fifth Avenue Marina. He called the property Shade Tree.
I quit my November 27, 1979. I walked off the job. Never went back, and then I bought Shade Tree, and that became the beginning of 40 years of fabulous good times. And I watched the waterfront change over the years. The city of Oakland was always looking down my back, but they always kind of left me alone because I always tried to do things right. I always made sure the shrubs were trimmed and raked, and always cleaned the beaches down there, and I made it into it was a real community. I always called it the neighborhood that time forgot.
It really does look like a place that time forgot. There's even a few earthquake shacks on the property. that were originally constructed for San Franciscans who lost their homes during the 1906 disaster. However, this valuable stretch of Oakland's waterfront was not forgotten about by developers, at least as far back as the 1990s, when gentrification was still just a whisper. I was able to find media reports that shade trees' days were numbered. The articles always described the place as ramshackle and makeshift before explaining how this scruffy bohemian backwater will soon be leveled to make room for this or that development. And indeed, the waterfront properties around Fifth Ave have been transformed drastically in recent years. But the neighborhood that time forgot, it's still standing.
I've never been a tough guy, but I did hold them at bay for 40 or 50 years. And the building inspector came down when they found out about developer, I assume, called the building inspector and said, go down and look at that rat's nest that Schultz created down there and condemn it. And they came down with the building inspector and they went through it with a fine-tooth comb and they said, this place is up to code. There was entrances and exits and fire exits and all that stuff. And they couldn't find anything wrong with my construction, even though it was all used material that I had salvaged out of buildings that were being torn down along the waterfront. I'd harvest timbers and wiring and electric panels and stuff and windows and doors. So it all looked, it was made of vintage material that I gleaned from buildings that the port was tearing down to put in containers, and Howard Terminal supplied a bunch of stuff and insulation and whatever. So it was a good one. And it's still there, and it'll be there long after I'm gone, wow. I hope.
The legacy of Fifth Ave Marina is much bigger than just the place itself. Just to give one example, if you've ever been to Chicago, you've probably seen a famous sculpture there that serves as the centerpiece for Millennium Park. It's a huge tourist attraction. That statue's real name is Cloud Gate, but everybody calls it the Bean because it looks like a ginormous, perfectly smooth and reflective bean. That 100-ton, $23 million metal bean was fabricated in a shop down at Fifth Ave Marina by a guy named Ethan Silva. And that's just one of the countless works of art that have been produced there. All right, so this is usually the part of the intro where I sum up what the big themes of the episode are going to be and tease out some questions that are going to be answered and all that. But you know what? Keeping in the spirit of Schultz, with all his unpredictability and bizarre plot twists, I'm not going to do any of that. But I am going to tell you to stick around if you want to hear about Mr. Bristles, Schultz's 300-pound pet pig, who he would cruise around with in his vintage Rolls Royce. What? Exactly. This is East Bay Yesterday. I'm Liam O'Donohue. Stay tuned.
I was born on a farm in Nebraska in 1936, and we had no electricity and no running water. And it was an old German farm. It was a good farm, and it was, Nebraska is just absolutely flat. There is was nothing, the windmills were the most proud part of the standing proud of the landscape, that and the occasional barn here and there. And I always wondered what was out there. There had to be more than Nebraska. And so on the day I turned 18, I joined the Navy and went to boot camp, took the Zephyr out to San Diego. And that was the fall of 54. And I arrived in San Diego and I went to see the ocean, and the guy said, take number 13 bus, go up to Point Loma at the lighthouse and you'll see the ocean. And I got on the bus and went up there, and I went got off the bus and walked to the lighthouse, And there was the Pacific Ocean. It was the most amazing thing I had ever seen. It was just incredible for a farm kid from Nebraska to see all that water and crashing waves and all that sort of thing. And so I've always stayed close to the water.
After getting discharged from the Navy in 1958, Schultz used the GI Bill to cover his tuition and enrolled at the California College of Arts and Crafts in Oakland. While he was looking for places to practice painting, he found inspiration down at the waterfront.
One of my favorite places was the end of Fifth Avenue. You could leave Arts and Crafts and we'd go on what we call field trips. You'd take your board and your watercolors and sketch pads and whatever. And you'd leave Arts and Crafts and go down to the Fifth Avenue on the old waterfront, because there were lots of sunken ships and old wooden vessels and a lot of decay from the turn of the century was on the waterfront in those days. So it was a visual exciting place, because there were no fences and you could carefully wander through the old sunken ships and clamber aboard the old tugboats. And, you know, there wasn't so much legality and there was certainly no signs that you could just kind of poke around. And it was a wonderful place. A lot of houseboats, because you could just about tie up. That was before the days of BCDC, and you could just tie up an old scow just about anywhere.
BCDC is the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission. It's a government agency that was created in the 1960s to oversee conservation efforts and regulate development. Before BCDC was established, things along the waterfront had gotten a little haphazard, to put it mildly.
There was one huge building that was an old warehouse that was, it's still there, but you wouldn't recognize it, that it got turned into restaurants and a port. When I first saw it in the 50s, pigeons were flying in and out of it. It was broken windows and the waterfront at Jack London Square had kind of decayed. There was an old raggedy waterfront restaurant about the same as Heinhold's at the far end of, to the west of Jack London Square. It was called the Bow and the Bell, and it was all covered with old ship parts and raggedy timbers and stuff. And just to the west of that was the Oakland garbage pier, where all the garbage went aboard barges and they would haul it to sea and feed the fish with it.
Schultz started working down at the waterfront while he was still in college. First, he was a rigger at Moore Dry Dock, which basically involved moving around timbers and scaffolding for the boats that were being repaired. That gig paid $3 an hour, and Schultz did the night shift so he could take art classes during the day. Another job was on the Eureka, an old steamer ferry, which happens to be one of the largest wooden ships still in existence. Schultz's work was mostly scraping and hammering. But he learned a lot about historic restoration on that job, because one of the guys in charge was a curator at the De Young Museum. Schultz told me that a lot of creative types were drawn to the docks around this time. The living was cheap, there was a sense of adventure, and best of all, plenty of space. In places like Fifth Avenue Marina, something new was beginning to blossom from the ashes, the literal ashes of what had been there before.
Well, in the early days, turn of the century, Hurley Marine Shipyard had the world's largest marine railway. They could haul a 300-foot ship on the railway. And Hurley Marine, that Fifth Avenue area, was all of their offices, storehouses, workshops, pattern shops. They built ships down there, World War I, minesweepers and stuff like that. So when Hurley Marine folded up their tent, And it changed hands, and there were several big warehouses that were filled. When I moved down there, or went down there in the 50s, there was a lot of Army-Navy surplus in those buildings. Spools of brand-new rope, hundreds and thousands of life jackets. My God, there was thousands of stacks of brand-new oars from lifeboats and just all kinds of surplus. And then there was a major fire. Boy, it was a like 1956 or so. There was a major fire down there and took out several of those big warehouses there.
Sometime after this fire, two buddies, a lawyer and an airline pilot, bought about 9 acres of Fifth Ave property for about $90,000. According to Schultz, they, quote-unquote, liked to party and encouraged a sort of free-for-all atmosphere.
Fifth Avenue had the most greatest houseboat community. All the artists and bohemians lived on a houseboat. That was the best part of it, because you could party, stay up at night, and your like fellows, is that's where they hung out. Mm.
So even back then in the 50s, it was already a bohemian kind of artistic place for creative people living kind of on the margins.
Yeah, and a lot of old sailors, you know, deep water sailors had retired from sailing, and they all hung out down around Fifth Avenue. So there was always somebody abandoning a tugboat when they would get leaky, and they'd just run them onto the mud, and people would live in them.
Did the sailors and artists get along pretty well?
Oh, yeah. I think sailors and artists are about the same kind of people, kind of wayward drifters. Don't set their anchors well. They're just kind of moving about, you know, looking for life.
This atmosphere of lawless partying wasn't just limited to Fifth Ave. All the way down to Livingston Pier, about a mile south, the waterfront was clogged with creaky old scows. People would sail in for a weekend of pig roasts and drinking and games and just never leave. The vibes were definitely crusty and rusty. But remember, a lot of these people were artists, so they had an eye for how to pretty things up a little bit, too.
Everybody in those days was nuts about plants. We always had, whenever you take over an old shed, you just get succulents and trees and boxes, and everybody had an old truck bed full of plants, or everybody was growing plants. It was took the edge off the old raggedy waterfront.
After college, Schultz started working full-time for the Oakland Parks Department. But on the side, he was always fixing up old cars. He fell in love with the hobby while still in high school. His first car was a 1937 Cadillac. Anyway, he needed a place for his workshop, so he started renting a lot down at Fifth Ave. Once he had this foothold, he started spending more and more time there.
I rented that chain link fenced area about 100 by 100, and I tore down a chicken coop up in Santa Rosa and moved it down, and I built a building along there to keep a half a dozen cars. And there was a little shipyard office. There were so many of these little 10 by 10 foot buildings on skids that they'd move around the shipyard for stage riggers or line handlers or whatever. And I took one of those buildings and I made it into a kind of a bedroom. And my old friend called it a snake pit. He said, "I know what you're doing now. You're going to bring some gals down here. What you're up to?" And he said, so he went and bought a bottle of Old Forester, and he said, "This will help you get started." So he always had everybody had a bottle on the old waterfront. Brandy was a big one, and he always had a little glass of whiskey for anybody that stopped by. And you always had a wood stove going, because there was so much wood floating around the estuary in those days. You just bring scraps of driftwood, would get floats up on the beach and it'd dry out. And then you always had a good warm winter fire, maybe make up a big pot of soup, and people would come down around and get out of the weather and just hang and shoot the breeze and talk about art and life in the slow lane.
As you've probably gathered by now, Schultz is a pretty social guy, so he started recruiting more and more of his friends down to Fifth Ave. The area didn't have many amenities. They called one of the unpaved stretches Bump Bump Road, but it was perfect for artists. Some of these guys would eventually go on to have distinguished careers, among them Lundy Segrist, Bill Snyder, and even Gary Knox Bennett, who made a fortune selling roach clips and hippie jewelry through his company Squirkin' Works, before eventually becoming a renowned furniture maker.
Little by little, the artists moved into Fifth Avenue and started occupying the various buildings. And Silvera was quick to rent, you know, space because the city of Oakland kind of, it was a no man's land. And so people, artists being the creative types, would take an old shack and cover the walls with fabric, and burlap was a big deal in those days, that you get yardage of burlap and oranges and earth colors, and you'd just staple it up on the walls and make it kind of presentable for living, and tin cans over the holes in the walls. Oh man, it was whatever worked.
The person who owned most of the land at Fifth Ave was a guy named J.W. Silvera. But Schultz's workshop was on a plot of land owned by Bud Potter. Potter lived on the property in a rather unusual kind of setup.
Bud Potter, God rest him, wonderful man, very reclusive, but yet I was good friends with him. He had made himself, he'd moved a trailer house in alongside the building and walled it right in, and it had a secret door. It was a big steel cabinet, and that steel cabinet was on hinges, and you'd grab that steel cabinet and you'd swing the cabinet out, and behind the cabinet was a trailer house door. And he lived in this about 30-foot trailer built right into the building. You never know it was there. It was secret. So I went over to see Bud, and he was always sitting in this derelict building smoking cigarettes. And he'd cough. You'd think he was going to die. And he'd reach over, he'd put the cigarette in a 7-Up quart bottle and put the lid on. They had bottles of cigarettes in these bottles, butts of old cigarettes in these plastic 7-Up bottles. And then he would grab his cutting torch. And when you'd think he was just about ready to take his last... He'd take this torch and put it in his mouth and turn the oxygen on. And he'd come back. I said, Bud, you're going to have to quit those cigarettes. Nah. He said, I don't know what it is. I said, something makes me cough. And he said it wasn't the cigarettes. But
the reason why Schultz went to visit his landlord on this fateful day is because he'd outgrown his workspace. Schultz had so much clutter jammed into his studio that it was starting to collapse in on itself.
So I said, in disgust, I said, Bud, I just dropped a clamp on my paint job, and I'm so jammed up over there. Could I rent a space from you in this big, huge, it was 125-foot long property with a 100-foot warehouse, 65 wide and 100-foot long. And it was originally Pacific Carbonic Gas Company. But anyway, Bud Potter said, why don't you buy the damn building from me? I said, Bud, everybody, Silvera's tried to buy it, the Ports tried to buy it, you never sell it. He said, I'd sell it to you because you're as nuts as I am. And I said, are you serious? And he said, yeah. And he was off the grid. So he said, take those three wires there and wire them to this telephone. And I got a dial tone. He said, call your fancy real estate buddy. And my buddy Bob came down with a contract, and the old man pulled out his magnifying glass and signed that contract for $125,000. Oh my God! I said, Bob, I don't have any money. I'm just working for the city of Oakland, and I think I was making like $200 a week or something like
that. Doing what?
Schultz's job title was exhibits designer for the Parks Department. So that meant he was always working at places like the zoo and Children's Fairyland. He designed some of the classic Fairyland attractions like Cat and the Fiddle, Billy Goat's Gruff, and Three Men in a Tub. Oh, and of course Schultz played the Mad Hatter in some of the Fairyland performances, but that's a whole other story. Back to the topic of buying land from Bud Potter, Schultz ended up getting a loan from a rich friend who lived up in Piedmont. But of course, this being a Schultz story, there's one more unexpected twist. It happened in the very last stages of finalizing the land sale. And if Schultz weren't so quick on his feet, the whole deal probably would have collapsed.
We went to the Great Western Title Company, and again, just not quite legal. We were sitting there, and the old lady said, she wasn't old, she was probably 60, but she was a lot older than me at 47. So she said, "Mr. Potter, do you have some ID of some sort?" And he kind of looked befuddled. And I said, "Well, Mr. Potter keeps a lot of his books and paperwork on the dashboard of his old raggedy truck." And she said, "Well, if you have something with his name on it, like a PG&E bill or something, just before I put it in the notary book, I've got to have some ID." So we went out to the truck, and I said, "What's the problem, bud?" He says, "Well, I don't have any. I put that building in my brother's name to avoid the taxes on it, and I don't know what I'm going to do." And I said, and he had that big fat billfold that old men carry. And I opened up that billfold, and here is a raggedy old paper thin Social Security card from 1936. And I eased it out of the old celluloid, and I took a pencil and I sharpened it on the concrete, and I took the rubber eraser and I erased the Lewis L. Potter off there, and I put in Bud Potter, like a typewriter had written it, and smudged it a bit, and we took it back to the lady, and she stamped, looked at it, said, "Oh, fine, thank you, that'll work." Stamp, 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 stamp. So I bought Potter's building. No water, no electricity to speak of, and it was just, it wasn't even a bathroom in it. It was just a big shed, corrugated tin shed, and the roof was rusty. It looked like lace up there. Barely cast a shadow, the old man would say. And the building, it virtually didn't have any floors in it, so I had a deal going with Kaiser, and they would bring me all their leftover concrete, and I poured new floors and new foundation, jacked that building up, and then went over to Alameda and got old corrugated tin and got matching rusty tin. So when I got some old windows, some big industrial, beautiful mullion windows when I was tugboating over in San Francisco. We were tied up at Pier 3, and they had started tore down some warehouses over there on the waterfront, and they had stacks of these beautiful wooden frame windows. So I got half a dozen of those on the tugboat, and I motored them back over to Oakland, and they went into that building. And so as I did the remodel on it...
Schultz added a lot more than just plumbing and new windows. Once he was in charge, the property started to reflect its new owner's eccentric character. One particular installation exemplifies this surreal transformation.
I got a letter from the Port of Oakland one year, and they said, "We remove all landscaping and art." I had a 30-foot tooth that Seward Johnson had shipped out of here from New York. So that big molar, that put me on the map for the longest time. And I think the Port of Oakland kind of got it bent out of shape, because it kind of sat out into the street. It was kind of nestled up tight against the building. And I remember in the earthquake of 89 that I had chained that tooth down to the railroad track so it wouldn't tip over, because it was a molar. It was a big tooth. And so it was banging on the building when the earthquake came. It was hitting that big steel shed.
The tooth was eventually moved, by the way. It served as a popular roadside attraction in a few different cities since its time in Oakland. But that giant molar wasn't the only curiosity that began attracting more and more people down to this weird stretch of waterfront. As it turned out, Schultz would have plenty of time to focus on turning Shade Tree into a trippy wonderland, because around the same time he bought the property, he spontaneously quit his job. It's not that he didn't like working for the Parks Department. He loved it. But he was constantly getting reprimanded by his boss.
He'd called me in before on several incidents, because I was always up to some kind of shenanigan. And so he always, one time he told me, he said, "Schultz, I want you," it was one of them rare 100-degree days in Oakland, and all the guys at the park department wore shorts. And I'm not a short-wearing guy, but I thought, well, I'll wear shorts. Everybody at Fairyland and the zoo is, so I'll wear them too. So I came in to work with Shorts at the Corpyard at Edgewater, and he came out in the shop and he said, "I want you to go home and get on some decent clothes." And I said, "Yes, sir, I will do that right away." So I went home and I unzipped my tuxedo that I bought in Hong Kong, and I put on the studs, and I put on the starched shirt and the cummerbund and the patent leather shoes. And I got on this maroon tuxedo and I went back to work. And he came out and he took one look at me and just was livid with rage. So he said, "I want you to go down to Lake Merritt today and I want you to pull out 3 El Toros," because we had rental sailboats on the lake at that point. And he said, "I want you to refinish them, paint them all, paint 3 of them, varnish the mast, paint the bottoms in green, and paint the hulls white and varnish the woodwork." And I said, "Yes, sir." And I went down there and everybody said, "Schultz, I'll loan you my coverall." I said, "No, I'm gonna do it in my tuxedo." And I brought those boats out to the Corpyard and set them up on sawhorses, and I scraped the barnacles off. But didn't get a drip of paint on me anywhere. I was good at that. My mom always said my dad could paint a house in a suit and never get a spot on him.
The final confrontation with his boss came when Schultz refused to wear a watch. Apparently, being on time, not one of his best qualities. After a few minutes of arguing, Schultz just walked out of the parks department. And he never had a full-time job for the rest of his life. From that point on, he was free to scour flea markets, make art, and of course, fix up old cars. Shade Tree turned into a kind of gallery/studio/living performance piece.
I had decorated it kind of like a museum with old cars and paintings, like collected a lot of art from the old waterfront people that couldn't pay rent, whatever. I just take a painting in lieu of the rent. So the place was kind of open to the public, and I always liked to entertain. I had a guest book for years that people from all over the world, Australia, New Zealand, Switzerland, Norway, Germany, England, I always enjoyed people from other countries coming by and, "What in the world is this?" I said, it's a living sculpture. You're part of it. It's a living sculpture, and I put people in it, like it becomes art that way. And so it was one of the very first live work studio spaces, but it was a wonderful, wonderful thing for many years.
Once a year, this steady stream of visitors turned into a flash flood. That's because on the third weekend of March, Schultz would host a massive party called Rites of Spring. There would be cotton candy machines. The fire department would come and let kids climb all over their ladders. And sometimes friends would pay tribute to Schultz by bringing him unusual gifts.
I had a pet pig down there for many years, Mr. Bristles. A guy for my birthday gave me Lauren worked at the zoo in Oakland, and he went out to the prison farm and got me a 40-pound pig. And he gave it to me for my birthday. We had about 1,500 people. It was 1976, and Tribune used to always come down, and it was a front page article with photographs. I had a game called an anvil toss, and you threw a 125-pound anvil. You threw it for distance, and so people came from all over the country to go to that annual. It was a 2-day, 3-day party, I guess. Always had a big pot of beans on the wood stove and a half dozen kegs of beer and whatever. And gypsy, we always had belly dancers, and I always enjoyed music. So we always had a half an hour or so or an hour of country music, and then we'd have rock and roll, and then we'd have an orchestra and Strauss waltzes. It was a good party. And the pig... Oh, Lauren brought me this pig, and he said, "Happy birthday, here's your pig." And so I carried this 40-pound pig around for the day, and he was a nice pig. It was a big Polish China pig, basically white with a black neck around him. So it was the end of the day, and Lauren came to me and he said, "I'll take the pig now." And I said, no, that pig belongs to me, Lauren. You gave it to him for my birthday." And he said, no, you can't keep a pig. And I said, "Yeah, I can." So I kept the pig, and he turned into, the city of Oakland was getting rid of their civil defense crackers. They had 5 gallon tins of sealed in bomb shelters around Oakland in the basements of the big buildings. They had a shelter, civil defense shelters, and they had these crackers, and they were getting rid of all that stuff. And so I fed that pig survival crackers, and he ended up being 300 pounds. And I was driving a 34 Rolls Royce that I'd picked up off the streets of Oakland and fixed it up. And he loved riding that car. He'd hang out of the car just like a dog and weak, 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 as we'd roll around the streets. People would say, oh my God, what a beautiful car. And then they'd look in the back seat, and hanging out of the back window was this 300 pound pig.
So you were driving around in a old Rolls Royce through the streets of Oakland with a giant pig hanging out of the back seat that you'd fattened up on bomb shelter crackers.
That's Mr. Bristol. And he ran free. I had an old raggedy dog, and they'd run the neighborhood just. And then one day there was Freddie Foster was a motorcycle cop, and he had brought a guy to a halt down there on Fifth Avenue. It was a big grassy, about 100 by 100 square foot grassy field between the Fifth Avenue and the access street and the shipyard. And Mr. Bristles would roam that grass, and he loved to eat that big fresh green grass. And I see this, I look out the door of my shop, and I see this Freddie. He was a big guy. He was the biggest guy on the, he was a motorcycle cop, big guy, and he pulled up somebody, and he was standing there writing him a ticket. And I looked across the street, and I said, hey, anybody seen a pig around here? And he looked at me, and he said, Schultz, you stay out of this, because the Black Panthers just started calling the cops pigs. And so at that point, he said, Schultz, you stay out of this. Boy, and all of a sudden, this Mr. Bristles come up out of the weeds, and he walked up to Freddie's big motorcycle boots and took this big nose with mud and grass and started snorting up against Mr. Freddie Foster's boots. Schultz, get this pig away from me! And so I called, come, Mr. Bristles, and ring, 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 and here he come running over to the shop. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Fifth Avenue, what a great place. Oh, my God.
Up until the mid-1800s, Oakland's waterfront was a vast tangle of ever-shifting wetlands. There were a few modest wooden wharves that the Peralta family used for shipping out cowhides and tallow from their cattle ranch, but that was about it in terms of development. Then, the Gold Rush. San Antonio Creek was renamed the Oakland Estuary. It was dredged, developed, and transformed from a marsh into one of the busiest ports on the planet. That complete reshaping of the landscape only took about a century or so, which is really just the blink of an eye in the grand scheme of things. During the decades that Schultz spent at Fifth Ave, he witnessed some incredible changes. The construction of 880, practically right on his doorstep, the dismantling of Alameda's industrial shipyards right across the channel, Schultz saw seedlings that he planted with a spoon grow into towering palms. Sometimes these transformations were gradual, a coat of rust slowly creeping across the wall of a corrugated metal warehouse. But other times, the skyline changed right before his eyes.
I was working on the gibbon cage out at Nolan Park. I was putting the play apparatus in that cage for the gibbons. And that was a 90-foot-tall, umbrella-like structure.
Nolan Park is where the Oakland Zoo is located, and gibbons are a kind of ape.
And I was clear up on the top of that 90-foot structure on the top of that hill at Nolan Park, and I see this giant crane piercing the skyline because, you know, the skyline along the waterfront was kind of maybe 3 stories tall. And here is this huge crane just dwarfing the waterfront. And they had picked off Quinn's Lighthouse. It was the old Coast Guard station at the very end of the estuary. And they lifted that station off, that Coast Guard lighthouse off the end of the estuary, and moved it down there and set it on pilings that they had put in. And it was a great logistic situation. That crane was called the Marine Boss. It was a 1,000-ton lift, and it was coming down the estuary, coming down the coast, and they came into the estuary for one day, and it was $1,000 an hour, and they lifted that Quinn's Lighthouse off, moved it down to 19th Avenue, set it on the pilings, and went back to sea with that crane all in one day. And Quinn's Lighthouse, it was a great spot.
That building, Quinn's Lighthouse, that Schultz saw being moved in 1965, eventually reopened, not as a lighthouse, but as a restaurant. Generations of Oaklanders went to Quinn's for fish and chips, or maybe to sing along on one of the sea shanty nights. But a few months ago, Quinn's closed up shop. They had a good run, but eventually it came to an end. The lighthouse is dark once again. Schultz's time at the waterfront eventually came to an end, too.
It was a wonderful, wonderful lifestyle because my rents were about half what they were supposed to be, and I just rented people that couldn't pay rent and wouldn't pay rent. But it was okay, as long as I could make the payments and pay the taxes. And so I bought it in 79 and I sold it, in 2001 or so, along in there. I had a long run of it. Yeah.
As you've been hearing, Schultz has many, many fond memories of Fifth Ave. Unfortunately, his final visit there was not a storybook ending.
I had collected 25 automobiles and all my welding and my sculpture equipment and my, paintings and sculptures and art and, just tons and tons of stuff because I had a half an acre to play with. And I'm a dumpster diver extraordinaire. And so I drug home a lot of stuff. But over the years, I had all these automobiles and all the spare parts to go with them. And unfortunately, one of my friends had sublet to a gal down there, and she took it upon herself to allow a junkie to come in. They had told me that they were going to keep my welding sculpture space. I was going to be there as kind of the founder of Shade Tree, and that I could leave my welding equipment and a lot of my tooling and stuff like that, and all the steel shapes that I'd collected to build sculpture out of. The kids always say that I'm the father of steampunk because I built what the museum calls fantasy machines. They look like a machine, but they don't do anything. But they have great stories. But anyway, they allowed a guy to come in and take everything that wasn't nailed down, and he hauled truckloads of stuff out of there. And I came back after the weekend, and it was cleaned out. And I fainted. I fell to the ground. I was just blown away that it happened. I couldn't believe it, that after 40 or 50 years being there, that all that stuff got thrown in the dumps, Rolls-Royce parts and radiators and Cadillac engines and all kinds of great stuff went to the dumps, Schnitzers. But
Was he like selling it for like scrap?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
All my sculpture and tools and just equipment and all the spare parts for Cadillacs, 30s and 40s Cadillacs over the years, radios and heaters and what I call the jewelry for the old cars, and all went away. And so I kind of left with a bad taste in my mouth, and I just kind of washed my hands of it, and I've never been back. But that's the only constant in life is change. It's one of those things, as times change, it's a tough one for me, but I've gotten over it and I'm happy here in Martinez.
Various developers had their eye on Fifth Avenue for decades, but around the time Schultz left, pressure really started ramping up. Oakland's new mayor, Jerry Brown, was ushering in a whole new era of redevelopment, and he was courting investors from all over the world. as the Brooklyn Basin Project, which is directly adjacent to Fifth Ave, inched closer and closer to reality, it seemed increasingly likely that the scrappy old marina and shade tree would be wiped from existence. The story of how it escaped this fate could fill up a whole other episode, but what it comes down to is that people were willing to fight for it and risk everything they had to save it. There was, of course, a fundraising campaign, and on August 3rd, 2017, the website Shade Tree Artisans posted a triumphant message. It read, quote, "The money has been transferred, the documents have been signed, and Shade Tree is now safely in the hands of its residents." Regardless of this victory, within the next few years, Fifth Avenue will be sandwiched between brand new developments, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. Oakland needs new housing, and the developers had to include parks and affordable units as part of the deal. Plus, like Schultz said, change is inevitable. But it is comforting to know that amidst all this transformation, one little slice of Oakland's shoreline will still provide a portal to the past. And when the residents of those new buildings look out their windows and see eccentric sculptures and patchwork architecture and overgrown succulents, hopefully they'll be inspired to learn about the history of their scrappy neighbor and the man who helped make it all possible.
I was designing clothes there was a fancy dress shop in Oakland, and I'd design gowns out of fabric and just pin them together. And people would say, "Well, you gonna copyright that concept?" And I said, "No, I've always been nuts about sharing workspaces and sharing materials that I gather and helping other people do their thing as well, because my joy is, you know, I was born, I was the only child on a farm for first 10 years of my life, and so I was never around people much. And in the 50s and 60s, everybody was moving to Mendocino because they wanted to get away from people. And I said, man, people are the flowers of my world. They come in different colors and sizes and fragrances, and I love people. So I was nuts about being around people, because the farm there was grandma and grandpa and dad, and that was about it. Yeah. And so I always enjoyed parties and people and sharing my spaces and stuff with my experiments and my excitement in life.
That is the end of today's episode, but you haven't heard the last of Schultz. I'm hoping to make a video, because guess what? You'll never believe it. Schultz has many, many more fabulous stories to share. This video stuff is new territory for me, so yeah, we'll see how it goes, but I'm excited to give it a shot. All right, stay tuned for the credits to hear more details. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of East Bay Yesterday. If you enjoyed it and want to know more about local history or hear about upcoming events, please sign up for my newsletter. It's free, and it's where I announce all my most important updates, like new boat tours, for example. Those will be coming very soon, I promise. I'm just putting the final touches on a whole new set of stories. And what else? Oh, on April 9th, I will be speaking at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. I'm doing a thing on April 25th with Oakland Side at the New Parkway. And you know, there's a ton of stuff coming up, so just sign up for the newsletter. East Bay Yesterday at Substack. You can find the link to that and my social media accounts at eastbayyesterday.com. And extra big shout out to those of you supporting East Bay Yesterday, either through Patreon or through the Substack. All those little donations add up, and I'm very, very grateful to each and every one of you. Truly, from the bottom of my heart, thank you, thank you, thank you. Also, a huge shout out to Vinny from Fifth Ave. And as I was putting the final touches on this episode, I heard some breaking news. Quinn's Lighthouse, which I just mentioned a few minutes ago. It's actually reopening under new ownership. Apparently, a Vietnamese family, the Trans, are taking it over and have some very exciting new menu items in store. So, yeah, keep an eye out for that. Good luck to the Trans. Supposedly, it's opening next month, and that story was broken by the East Bay Times. So thank you for bringing us that good news. One other thing I should mention is that unless you're with someone who lives there or has a studio there or a boat there, it's not really cool to just go down to Fifth Avenue and poke around. But if you want to see it for yourself, I do have some good news. I literally just found this out yesterday. But on April 20th, starting at 10 a.m., there will be a Fifth Avenue Marina spring cleaning yard sale. Apparently, there will be vintage clothes, costumes, junk, jewels, treasures, oddities, and curiosities. That's all I really know. And by the way, that is not a paid ad, just a public service announcement. Okay, music for this episode came from Lobo Loco. That's about it. I've been your host, Liam O'Donohue. Please don't forget to subscribe to this podcast if you want to hear more East Bay Yesterday. And if you like this episode, share it with a friend. Thanks a lot.